Chapter 18. A few examples of the cult in theory and in practice. What a striking contrast there was between Louis Pasteur, the worn, paralyzed man, aged before his time, and the magnificence of the institute founded in his honor and named after him, which was opened on 14 November 1888, at Paris. The ambitious chemist had achieved his goal, fame and fortune. He was now installed as the idol of medical orthodoxy. The reason for the general public's acclamation of his views has been succinctly explained by Bechamp in the preface to La Théorie du Microzyme. Here he writes, "The general public, however intelligent, are struck only by that which it takes little trouble to understand. They have been told that the interior of the body is something more or less like the contents of a vessel filled with wine, and that this interior is not injured, that we do not become ill, except when germs, originally created morbid, penetrate into it from without, and then become microbes. The public do not know whether this is true. They do not even know what a microbe is, but they take it on the word of the master. They believe it because it is simple and easy to understand. They believe and they repeat that the microbe makes us ill without inquiring further, because they have not the leisure, nor, perhaps, the capacity, to probe to the depths that which they are asked to believe. On the other hand, experts have been educated from the start to consider micro-organic life from the Pasteurian standpoint, and to accept these theories as though they were axioms. Thus it is perhaps understandable that it is only from an unbiased vantage ground that the contradictions of the germ theory of disease can be correctly understood to be ridiculous. Its rules, the postulates of Dr. Robert Koch, state, inter alia, that a causative disease germ should be present in every case of a disease, and never found apart from it. What are the facts? One of the original props of Pasteurian orthodoxy, the Klebs-Loeffler bacillus, arraigned as the culprit behind diphtheria, was, by Loeffler himself, found to be absent in 25% of the cases, while, on the other hand, it is constantly revealed in the throats of healthy subjects, since, as Bechamp explained long ago, a bacterial evolution of microzymas is not necessarily noxious. The followers of Pasteur, however, have their method of overcoming the theoretic difficulty, namely, the carrier theory, by which healthy people are accused of propagating certain germs, which they then supposedly disseminate. This accusation has been brought against those who have never in their entire lives suffered from the complaints that they are accused of distributing, while, in one noted case, that of a certain cook, Mrs. Roberts of Wrexham, whose microscopic inhabitants were said to have dealt out intestinal trouble, it was found that she had never seen, much less even touched, the pork pies described as the delivery medium of her murderous microbes. In their Manual of Infectious Diseases, Goodall and Washburn state, "Enteric fever differs from other infectious diseases in not spreading directly from individual to individual. There is thus little danger in visiting patients suffering from the disease. Yet while actual victims of the fever are pronounced innocuous, no hesitation is shown in accusing healthy persons, some of whom have never undergone the complaint, of being promoters and disseminators of it. The carrier theory is also constantly invoked in connection with diphtheria. Years ago, we read three of the throats of 700 schoolchildren at Alperton in Middlesex being examined, with the result that 200 were accused of being diphtheria carriers and were accordingly placed in isolation. One telling weakness of the theory is that we never seem to hear of the isolation of prominent bacteriologists, who obviously should set the example in undergoing microscopic and chemical tests and the subsequent quarantine, which is, apparently, only advocated for other people. But, as the editor of The Lancet has confined, without the carrier theory, Koch's postulates could not even pretend to be fulfilled. Take, for instance, Koch's fourth postulate, which defines the causative germ as producing in an animal the same disease with which it was originally associated. But we are told in the same article in The Lancet how the pneumococcus of pneumonia introduced into the lung of a rabbit brings about not pneumonia, but instead general septicemia. According to Bechamp's theory of the differences between the microzymas of varying species, this result is understandable and presents no mystery, but it is the undoing of Koch's fourth postulate. In Sternberg's textbook of bacteriology we find the demonstration made by Augustin, Rosenbach, Passett and others, that micrococci are constantly present in the pus of acute diseases, led to the inference that there can be no pus formation in the absence of microorganisms of this class. But it is now well established by the experiments of Krawitz, de Bary, Steinhaus, Schirlin, Kaufman and others that the inference was a mistaken one, and that certain chemical substances introduced beneath the skin give rise to pus formation quite independently of bacteria. On the other hand, Dr. Robb has shown that under the most rigid antiseptic treatment, microorganisms are constantly found attached to sutures when removed from wounds made by the surgeon, and that a skin abscess is frequently associated with the presence of the most common of these microorganisms, e.g. Staphylococcus albus. Thus, on the one hand, we are given evidence that pus formation may be independent of bacteria, while on the other the utmost precautions against microorganisms will not prevent their presence. From the viewpoint of Pasteur, this is a contradiction not easily accounted for by his theory of invasion. We are told by his son-in-law that it was his habit to speak of an invaded patient. Yet we have just been informed, on the one hand, of pus without any so-called microbes, and, on the other, of microbes when every precaution has been taken against them. This is very confusing, according to Pasteur's teaching. On the contrary, the matter is easily explained when we consider Bechamp's teachings. According to his doctrine, which, in keeping with a prudent approach to scientific investigation, he put forward as a probable hypothesis, instead of asserting it to be a proved fact, incapable of question, it seems possible to understand the malignant influence of certain chemical substances upon the normal microzymas of the body, and the pus formation that might be the consequence. In the other example, where microorganisms are seen, in spite of antiseptic precautions against external invasion, we are shown the apparent accuracy of Bechamp's view that the medium having become unsuited to normal microzymas, they themselves develop into bacteria, thus proving the latter to be the consequence, instead of the origin, of the disease condition. Another remarkable theory that has had to be invoked in support of the general germ theory is that of Metchnikoff's phagocytosis, or the assumption that the leukocytes, the white corpuscles of the blood, are in effect its scavengers which destroy undesirable intruders. A favorite description of them has been that of the police of the body, notwithstanding the salient fact that the more of them there are the less the body seems safeguarded, while it gains in security with the diminution of this hypothetical, police force. Bechamp taught that the leukocytes are living, but he disagreed with Metchnikoff's theory. He wrote in Les Grands Problèmes Medicaux, "The leukocytes are even held to be so much alive that they are represented as pursuing the microbes to swallow and devour them. The droll thing is that this is believed. But without phagocytosis, what would become of the whole doctrine of invasion and resistance and all the other popular theories?" One likely reason for the popularity of the germ theory of disease has been the explanation that it has been supposed to provide for the problem of infection. It is so easy to conjure up arrays of malignant microbes passing from one diseased subject to another. Such an idea has become prevalent, even among men of science. For instance, we find that before the Royal Commission on Vivisection, Dr. C.J. Martin of the Lister Institute is reported to have stated, "Pasteur's experience on this subject, fermentation, led him to the great generalization that infectious diseases might themselves be interpreted as particular fermentations and as due to specific microorganisms. By a series of masterly experiments on animals, he established the truth of his hypothesis in the case of anthrax, chicken cholera and swine erysipelas." These results of Pasteur's may be regarded as the foundation of the whole modern study of contagious diseases in both man and animals, and their extension by Pasteur and his pupils, and by bacteriologists and pathologists all over the civilized world, has led to the discovery of the causes of most of the infectious diseases to which man is liable. We have already compared Bechamp's and Pasteur's work on fermentation, and in regard to Pasteur's masterly experiments on animals we have seen something of the truth of his hypothesis in the case, for instance, of anthrax. Finally, in respect of the most infectious diseases, such as scarlet fever, measles and smallpox, no specific microorganisms are found in association, though that does not stop Pasteur's followers from claiming that they are there all the same, but are ultra-microscopic, even if this is hardly in accord with the cautiousness advocated by Pasteur. As Professor Bechamp once said, "If virulent germs were normal in the atmosphere, how numerous would be the occasions for their penetration independently by way of the lungs and intestinal mucus? There would not be a wound, however slight, the prick even of a pin, that would not be the occasion for infecting us with smallpox, typhus, syphilis, gonorrhea." In regard to this, we will quote a passage from Mr. Alexander Paul's summary of the preface to La théorie du microzyme. Mr. Paul writes, M. Bechamp argues that if the simple or evolved microzymas, which may be found in certain humors of the body, came from the air and penetrated so easily the cells of the human body, there is one humor, in ceaseless contact with the air we breathe, in which we should find them always the same in all animals. This is the saliva of the mouth. It is found, however, that the properties of human saliva and that of other animals are different. M. Bechamp says that the epithelial cells, the microzymas, and the bacteria of the tongue of man may have a certain chemical action unique to themselves, and altogether different from those of the tongue of the cow, the pig, the horse or the dog. Now, if the germs of the air do not operate to modify the function of a humor which is so unceasingly, so largely, and so directly in contact with the common air, it is difficult to understand how they operate to modify the functions of the inner tissues and humors, protected as they are by so many barriers. Were it not that the art of thinking is so rarely practiced, reflections such as these should have established long ago something to be at fault with the Pasteurian notion of the germ theory. And, even in cases where the germ hunter seems sure of his microbe, in a little while dire confusion is apt to overtake his certainty. Never, for instance, did there seem to be a better bolstered case than Sir David Bruce's arraignment of the Micrococcus melitensis in goat's milk as the cause of Malta fever. Yet when Dr. Walter R. Hadwin of Gloucester took up the defense, he proved the supposed offending germs to be innocent after all. The decline of the fever in the Navy was found to have had nothing to do with abstinence from goat's milk, but to have been gradual and to have coincided with the dredging of the harbor at Malta. Neither was the sudden drop in the army disease rate to be accounted for by avoidance of the milk, for it had already taken place before that beverage was banned, when the troops were mostly removed from the insanitary St. Elmo barracks to new quarters at a higher altitude. To these measures the improvement in our sailors' and soldiers' health was clearly traced by Dr. Hadwin's investigations, and the main effect of the Micrococcus melitensis was to gain a knighthood for its false accuser, while, incidentally, it occasioned a great deal of discontent among the Maltese population connected with the milk industry. Dr. Aegeus of Malta, who at the time went into the matter very thoroughly, found that bad sanitation was invariably the cause of outbreaks of fever in private houses, which were sometimes the quarters of British officers. On one occasion, it was only after a floor had been taken up that the real cause of the trouble was discovered. Yet upon a theory so constantly at fault when thoroughly examined there has been erected an entire system of inoculation. Or, perhaps, the facts may be stated conversely. Had it not been for the sale of sera and vaccines, nowadays grown to such vast proportions, Pasteur's germ theory of disease might before this have collapsed into well-deserved obscurity. It can hardly be denied that he committed an offense in dragging medical science down to a commercial level. Moreover, he has besmirched the name of science by associating it with cruelty. In this also, he was merely an imitator. He was the friend of men like Claude Bernard, who, in the words of Professor Metchnikoff, feel no scruples in opening bodies and submitting the animals to the most cruel sufferings. But, atrocious as is their torment, victims of the knife were and are few in number compared with the millions of animals that suffer in pathological laboratories, sometimes undergoing tests as fantastic and misleading as they are cruel, since they can never furnish real evidence of disease under natural conditions. As examples might be mentioned birds and rats kept in cramped cages, slowly devoured by fleas, so that some scientist can deduce whether the fleas convey sleeping sickness, without regard to the fact that the inevitable bad health of creatures thus tormented cannot with certainty guarantee anything other than the callousness of their tormentors. Or, again, the test of milk by its injection into guinea pigs, which, kept in covered tins, would by the mere fact of such unhealthy captivity be made liable to tuberculosis. Yet for this the ratepayer dips into his pocket, while for all he can tell, the milk he consumes may have come from a consumptive cow wading through a filthy farmyard and milked by a diseased individual into a dirty utensil. Hygienists in some part avert such conditions, leaving Pasteurians to torment their guinea pigs. The amount of harm that has ensued from the diversion of attention from real to false factors in the causation of ill health is probably incalculable. An example in this connection, with regard to plague in India, is the amount of time and money wasted over fleas and rats that might be expended upon the insanitary huts standing on filth-trodden soil, which Dr. Charles Creighton, in a treatise on the subject, has clearly shown to be breeding grounds of the pestilence. To return to the subject of milk, admirers of Pasteur may point in pride to the preservative method named after him, but even here the praise is so faint as to be damning. If we turn to the Journal of the Royal Society of Arts for September 19, 1919, we find an article entitled Problems of Food and Our Economic Policy, by Professor Henry E. Armstrong. Here we are told that the great reformer of recent times has been the chemist Pasteur. The extent to which he has influenced our doings is astounding. Professor Armstrong then shows how, thanks to Pasteur, wines were sterilized and the Grand Vin, the result of a fortuitous concourse of organisms, became a great rarity. The quality of wines was reduced to a low general average, though of course much was saved from the sewer. Beer suffered a like fate, though on the whole the changes were much to the public advantage. But the real harm was done when milk was tampered with. Dilution became a general practice, the public suffered from occasional dishonest tradesmen, and was in some instances deprived of the advantages up till then derived from dealing with the majority of purveyors who were honest. The blow was made all the heavier by the introduction of new engineering techniques for the separation of the cream. Then Pasteur's teaching became operative once more, aided this time by Coke. Milk was not only diluted, but also sterilized. Some lives may have been saved, but the step has undoubtedly been productive of untold misery. Not a few of us have long held, on general grounds, that a material produced as milk is cannot be heated above blood heat without diminishing its dietary value. Recent observations show indeed that the anti-scorbutic advent, which is none too abundant a constituent, is affected, although apparently the fat-soluble anti-rachitic and water-soluble anti-neuritic factors are not destroyed. But difficulties have been encountered in localities where the milk supply has been systematically sterilized, and it may well be that it suffers in quality in ways not yet elucidated. The inquiries thus far held into the effect of sterilizing are in no way satisfactory and are open to criticism on account of their incompleteness and unscientific character. The risks from typhoid and other similar infections are now slight, and the main object of sterilizing milk is to secure the destruction of the organism which is held to be responsible for tubercular disease. But it may well be that in destroying some one or other mysterious constituent of the advent class, the food value is so lowered that effects are produced which render the system specially sensitive to tubercular infection. Such infection seems always to be with us, apart from milk. Moreover, when milk is sterilized, the lactic organism is destroyed and it becomes a particularly favorable nidus for the growth of putrefactive organisms. It is therefore a potent cause of infantile diarrhea. Thus the verdict of time and unbiased criticism continue to pronounce judgment on the works of Pasteur. But if the mere consumption of impoverished food can be believed to be so injurious to the consumer, what must be the effect of the deluge of sera and vaccines introduced directly into the bloodstream? In spite of the modern medical mania for inoculations, a remarkable ignorance on the subject prevails among those most ready to submit to inoculation. Many cannot even distinguish between a serum and a vaccine. Serum, the colorless part of the blood, is usually, for use in inoculation, taken from the blood of a horse into which diseased matters have previously been injected. The strength of this serum is generally tested upon guinea pigs, that is to say, by their recovery or death from the sickness created by its injection into their bodies. Animal suffering comes into play in this connection from start to finish, while, as regards the human race, considering the danger of the introduction of the serum of one species into that of another, it is, perhaps, fortunate that serum therapy, although originally acclaimed as the panacea for all ills, has yielded in popularity to vaccine therapy. The latter, needless to say, has no connection with cows. Under Pasteur's tutelage, precision in nomenclature was as much lost as precision in theories. The name, vaccine, is now applied to microorganisms and their surrounding medium abstracted from a sick body, the organisms being left to multiply in a suitable nutritive substance, known as a culture, afterwards being usually killed by heat and prepared in various ways, according to the prevalent fashion. The nostrum is finally sold as a cure, or, more often, a preventive against the disease with which the microorganisms were originally associated. In this case, animals are spared a part in the preparation, though, owing to their use as test subjects, suffering is for them by no means prevented. We are here reminded of the homeopathic law of cure, that, like cures like, though what a contrast is presented to Hahnemann's scientific precision in allowing for individual idiosyncrasies. Whereas he applied his drugs by way of nature's laboratory, The stomach, the Pasteurian system, on the contrary, introduces substances directly into the blood, regardless of nature's precaution, i.e. the efficient coverings with which she has protected this life stream against all external intrusions. It has indeed become the fashion for humanity to consider itself wiser than, choose which name you will, nature or providence. We are well aware of the array of statistics with which Pasteurians confront the critics of the system of inoculation. In reply, we would say that statistics are worthless in proving results without full investigation and thorough allowance for the specific conditions from which they are derived. For instance, it is easy to parade a fall in the diphtheria fatality rate since the introduction of antitoxin. Yet that fall does not confirm the merits of the serum if it is seen merely to be the result of a case rate inflated by a bacteriological, as opposed to a clinical, diagnosis and the inclusion as diphtheria of cases which in the past would have been considered to be merely sore throat, tonsillitis, laryngitis, etc. This altered diagnosis in itself prevents proper comparison between past and present case rates. But if, with an inflated case rate, there is an increase, instead of a decrease, in the death rate, such an increase is surely highly significant. For instance, we find that, for the 15 years subsequent to the introduction of antitoxin, the number of deaths in England and Wales from diphtheria became 20% greater than they had been for the 15 years prior to the serum treatment. Though the Metropolitan Asylums Board's report of cases may seem to show at first sight, by a decreased death rate, that advantage accrues from the use of the antitoxin, their detailed particulars show the opposite to be the case. Whereas for the years 1895 to 1907 there were 63,249 cases of diphtheria treated with antitoxin, of which 8,917 died, giving a fatality rate of 14.09%, there were for the same years 11,716 cases not treated with antitoxin, of which only 703 died, giving a fatality rate of 6%. Footnotes to the tables show that of the latter cases, 55 were moribund when admitted and 12 died of diseases other than diphtheria, so that the fatality rate should in reality be under 6%. It is to be regretted that the cases treated with and without antitoxin are no longer listed separately in the Metropolitan Asylums Board's reports, and since 1930 the board itself has ceased to exist. From those cases that have been particularized, there seems to be no denying that improved methods of nursing and medical treatment, which should reduce deaths, accomplish this to a lesser degree when antitoxin is administered. The following table supplies proof of this view with regard to infantile diseases. We see here the remarkable decrease in measles, scarlet fever, and whooping cough, complaints not subject to treatment by inoculation, while diphtheria, with its specific antitoxin, shows an increase of 102 per million. The contrast is striking. The claim for immediate injection and the advantage of a first-day inoculation as compared with a second day, and so forth, may surely be dismissed for the following reasons. Before clinical symptoms are manifest, it is impossible to tell whether the trouble would ever be serious, if indeed the diphtheria be genuine, and if, on the one hand, it be asserted that the prompt administration of antitoxin has prevented dangerous illness, it is as easy to assert, on the other, that through antitoxin a mere mild sore throat has been aggravated into severe sickness, sometimes complicated by heart trouble and paralysis. The one method of argument is no more inexact and unscientific than the other. Also, one may ask, why, if diphtheria antitoxin is such a reliable remedy, should it have been found necessary to introduce the Schick system of preliminary test and subsequent immunization? The supposedly susceptible children should run small risk if provided with an infallible cure. If, in answer to this, it is argued that the immunization is for the prevention of diphtheria for all time, it may be retorted that statistics show no improvement upon natural immunity, while, moreover, in many cases the preventive has proved far more dangerous than the disease. Over and above these mass disasters, there are too many tragic cases of injury and death following inoculation for space to be allotted to more than a few of them in this volume. John Gordon Baker, age 7 years, of Saxholm Way, Bassett, died 5 days after his second inoculation against diphtheria. Dennis Hillier, aged 11, a healthy boy from London, excelled in games. He died 2 months after his second inoculation. William Martin Graham, aged 4 years, of Bonham, Wigton, died in the Birmingham Children's Hospital 2 days after being inoculated with alum-precipitated toxoid. Rosemary Jane Webb, Ernest Eales, Joan Hudgen and many more swell the lists of young victims who might be alive, but for Pasteurian medical methods. Neither has freedom from diphtheria resulted as a reward of the grave risks taken. During the 4 years 1941 to 1944, the Ministry of Health and the Department of Health for Scotland reported almost 23,000 cases of diphtheria in immunised children, of which more than 180 proved fatal. With regard to the decline of diphtheria in Great Britain during 1943 and 1944, we are reminded that 58 British physicians who signed a statement in 1938 against compulsory immunisation in Guernsey were able to point to the virtual disappearance of diphtheria in Sweden without any immunisation. On the other hand, if we turn to Germany, we find that, after Dr. Frick's order in April 1940 for the compulsory mass immunisation of children, this country in 1945 had come to be regarded as the storm center of diphtheria in Europe. From some 40,000 cases, there had been an increase to 250,000 cases. An article in the March 1944 edition of a publication called Pour la Famille documents the rise in cases of diphtheria after compulsory immunization. For instance, the increase in Paris was as much as 30%. And in Lyons the number of diphtheria cases rose from 162 in 1942 to 239 in 1943. In Hungary, where immunization has been compulsory since 1938, the rise in cases was 35% in 2 years. In the Canton of Geneva, where immunization has been enforced since 1938, the number of cases trebled between 1941 to 1943. A startling tragedy of Pasteurian preventive methods was the murder of innocents at Lübeck, during the early summer of 1930, from BCG, or the Calmette tuberculosis vaccine, a culture administered by mouth to newborn infants. The health department of the city made an emotional appeal to parents to allow immunization of their children, whether likely to grow up in a tubercular environment or otherwise. Of the 253 babies subjected to the Calmette treatment, 69 died of it and 130 were made seriously ill. In view of such a calamity, it is not surprising that the Reich Health Office decided that such prophylactics were not to be recommended, and the Reich Health Council considers an extension and tightening up of the existing regulations for the production, issue and employment of vaccines of all kinds to be desirable. Finally, we have to remember what wonderful statistical boasts have been demolished when genuine epidemics have made their appearance. For some considerable time, one of the trump cards, so to speak, of the research, i.e. vivisection, defense society was the anti-meningitis serum of Dr. Flexner and Dr. Jobling of the Rockefeller Institute, New York. Remarkable statistics were produced without explanation. The serum, first tried in the spring of 1907, was acclaimed as bringing about a complete revolution. Yet what use was this wonderful cure when a terrible outbreak of meningitis in New York, with a death roll of 745 for the single month of July 1916, transformed the American capital into a city of mourning? Flexner's marvelous serum was so useless that we find it barely gained a mention, and its discoverer confessed that, there exists at present no specific or curative treatment. It transpired, further, that this complaint, known also as spotted fever, is, at any rate according to bacteriological diagnosis, fast losing its limitation to childhood. Outbreaks of it are said to have been frequent among young men in military training camps. It has followed so suspiciously in the wake of anti-typhoid and other inoculations that, instead of such measures having provided safeguards for health, it would seem far more probable that they can be directly implicated in causing sickness. And now this brings us to a few lessons that we may be able to derive from the inoculation experiments that were practiced upon our fighting men during the course of two world wars.